The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
So welcome back to the 9 till noon show. It's Michaela Clark in this morning for Grey Cues. I'm delighted now to be joined by Belle Stevenson, who is a former neonatal nurse and author of One Day at a Time and founder of NICU and You. Good morning, Belle.
Good morning.
So I suppose we'll start with your experience as a neonatal nurse. Well, how did you find that? What kind of issues did you encounter in terms of, you know, lack of resources or issues that you felt women were encountering?
Okay, so my time as a neonatal nurse probably brought me to the realisation that parents are often forgotten about, not deliberately, but the focus is on that baby and you have to protect and preserve that life. Mm. So sometimes the parents do get overlooked, and that was the thing that really drew to me, like a hug, a touch, that reassurance, comfort, just to let them know that it's okay, you know, you're there for them, but also to sort of normalise that stressful, traumatic, overwhelming feeling and environment that, that neonatal is, and not to hide that.
Because it's such, you know, you have this newborn baby and then it's unimaginable thinking that that baby has to be removed, you know, to this neonatal ward. And that's such a difficult thing that no parent can ever imagine until they're in that situation. And to have the likes of yourself there, you know exactly how it operates is essential for them.
Yeah, so whenever the baby is born, so specifically for neonatal, the babies are normally emergency section or planned section, or there's something wrong, or mum's sick. So that baby is born in the theatre. Mum is then tended to. She's still there, being looked after. Baby has been taken by the neonatal team, looked after, and then taken to the neonatal unit. Mum's looked after, but taken to postnatal. Mm-hmm. So there's a period of separation immediately there, which really pulled at my heartstrings. And that's the gap that I have been trying to fix. Not totally, but I'm a small link in that to try and bring that something in there to try and help them through that wee bit of separation.
And you've created a pack now, you know, in response to those issues that you've highlighted. So what does the pack contain?
So the pack contains a book, and the book was written by myself, incorporating all like the medical terms that I have learnt and the knowledge that I've gained through neonatal nursing, with also the compassion, reassurance and comfort that they also need that's left out, not just for mum, but for their partners, for their family, for the siblings, you know, for the children and the family, and also the grandparents. You know, it's a pack that encourages them to speak out, to know that it is all right to feel like this and to ask for help. Don't hide it, because that's going to make things worse. The book, written by myself and designed completely by my daughter, who suffers mental health, always has, all her life. She's designed from front to back, and we designed it with all the cultures, religious ends. Everything is covered in that book so that nobody is left out.
For worldwide purposes?
For worldwide, universal purposes, inclusivity, everything. And it comes with a little pack, a handheld teddy bear, and a little stone, heart-shaped stone, for your purse or your wallet, your pocket, and a little card from the character in the book, whose name is Affy. It's a Maori teddy bear. And the message is that parents matter too. Mm-hmm. So it's the story from the baby's perspective. They're saying, hello, welcome, here's me.
Yeah.
I'm your baby. This is going to be a rough journey. But you know what? We'll take it one day at a time together. We'll share the milestones, yours and mine. Mm. Reach out. Don't be afraid to take, you know, ask for questions and take part in my care. But don't be afraid to ask, because it is a daunting thing
absolutely.
To see. You know, so it's trying to encourage that. And it's also, the whole thing is just trying to promote perinatal mental health and to, I suppose, stop that stigma attached to mental health where you're afraid to say, because I do know parents have hidden their feelings and pretended they're okay because they think that if they say they're not managing, that they'll be judged.
Yeah.
And that's going to make their mental health worse.
And I suppose parents, you know, if their child is placed in the neonatal ward, they maybe don't have, you know, when you go home with your baby, you have the health visitor coming to you. Maybe that mental health issue maybe is being missed as well, because they're so focused on the child in that moment.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, even, you know, perinatal mental health is through pregnancy as well. So, you know, up until, you know, they have the baby, there could be things, there could be signs maybe missed, because again, people hide, they try to hide this because there's a stigma attached to it. Mm. So they might have missed things. And then the ward, then again, they may miss things, might not always get it. And then when they go home and there's less contact with medical services, you know, that's when they would maybe, you know, hide away from it, think they're okay and they're going to be okay, but you know, they're not, and they need help. And the help is there. Just ask and ask and ask. And if you don't think you're being listened to, go up further and keep going and just make a noise, because you will get the help. And there's always people like me, different support organisations. You know, if you have messaging contacts or whatever, just contact people that you know. And we are a signposting entity where we can signpost you to somebody who can help you. But please, you know, I would encourage people just to be honest, speak up and reach out.
And do you think there are enough resources within the hospital setting and the community setting as well at the moment? Or do you think it's like everything, there's always a lot of work to be done?
I think there's a lot of work to be done. I'm just one little link, and the project, it's a project, it's not just one book, but the book is one link in my project to try and create more resources. But there's very little resources at that point, and in the hospitals, and I think they should push, and if they are pushing it in the north, but they should push for that, you know, mother baby medical care. Again, it's down to money, but that separation at birth is traumatic, and that carries on throughout your whole life. That affects the parent and the child forever. So if they want to curtail mental health, I think they need to start with the birth of that child that needs to be with that mother.
Yeah. And in terms of births, you talked about, you know, emergency cesareans. Would you know beforehand that this baby is going to, you know, end up in the neonatal ward, or is it just at the live birth? Could there be something in place to prepare the mother for that?
Yes, well, this is part of my project as well, where I'm trying to educate as well as be a compassionate ear. I think if we educate maybe during pregnancy with your, you know, your antenatal classes and that through the health services, if they had some kind of education program to be able to show them around neonatal units, explain the terms, explain the different conditions that can happen in pregnancy, take that fear away, so that whenever that happens, for example, preeclampsia, what is preeclampsia? You know, how do I notice it? What's the signs? You know, this is an incubator, this is oxygen, this is a monitor. You know, the fears around monitors have impacted on so many people that now they have PTSD. So that could reduce those fears if it was put in place beforehand.
Yeah, and I suppose prepare for, you know, it's a daunting, you know, thing, thinking about labour anyway. But, you know, if a mother's prepared for all eventualities, and that would maybe help labour as well. If something was going wrong, you know it's going to be okay at the end. In terms of the support that you have, you work on a cross-border basis. You've put these packs into hospitals in the north and here locally as well.
Yes, that's right. So it started off as I had won an award at uni, late learner, didn't do my nursing until my late 40s, so graduated at 50. And then I had won an award at university. It was the Gabriel Durkin Award. So through that I got a small amount of money, and it was supposed to do like a conference or do some training or something. But because I had been working in the neonatal unit, I was observing and talking to parents, and I thought, no, I need something in their hands. I need something that's going to be that touch, that hug, you know, just to bring the comfort. And that's how the book was born then, through that. So then at that point, I used the money to print over 100 copies. And then I thought, oh, let's see if I can go past one unit, because there's so many babies all over the world even. So then what became a local project went to, I had enough, well, it went over and above that. I subsidised it myself, but I had enough for one copy of the pack for every single neonatal space in Northern Ireland.
Right. Amazing.
And then I thought, well, there's a bit of Donegal in all of us, like, so it went then, oh, could I go across? And then I provided, my sister was working in Sligo, so I got 10 down to Sligo and I got 10 to Letterkenny as well. So, and then it's gone to New Zealand and it's gone to Boston, and just yesterday I've posted 60 to Canada on the request of a parent as well who has funding as well for that.
So do you get any funding from any organisations? It's just yourself or local fundraising events?
I started off just myself, but I couldn't sustain that. Mm. I was using just my own money for that. Could no longer sustain it. So I put a request out for local communities to maybe help do little fundraiser events to help their local hospitals. And that started with a few like wee bonus ball things, and then I decided I would run this coffee morning in the Christchurch in Strabane. It was a complete success, mm-hmm. and from that I was able to supply, in the middle of it at the minute, but I'm able to supply at least 100 to each hospital.
Brilliant.
In the north again.
Yeah.
So then I thought, well, what do we do about Donegal here, because I can't supply everywhere,
yeah.
because we're just getting off our feet. So I decided, oh, let's go and have a wee fundraiser in Donegal. So Oakfield Park, absolutely fantastic wee place. Coffee morning next Friday morning.
Yeah, 25th of July.
The 25th of July. And with the idea behind that being that any funds raised would help me produce enough packs now to go back to Letterkenny again and supply them with another batch.
Brilliant. And do you think that it will ever get to a stage? Have you had any talks with any organisations like the HSC? Would they be willing to get involved? I know it's such an early stage for you at the moment.
Yeah, I've been trying to reach out lately. Now I've been emailing different health organisations and that. Haven't got anything back yet, but I find it really hard to find the right person
to
get in touch with about it.
There's so many different sectors within
Yes, I have done so in the north. And again, the health minister did commend the project and said it was very much needed,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have the money because it was all going to frontline. So I'm presuming it's the same here.
Yeah.
But I'll keep trying and hopefully.
And what's the feedback been like from the parents that have benefited from these packs?
Well, parents are actually loving it.
Mm.
I'm not being biased, but they really are. And there's a few, I do have a website, and there's a few testimonials on the website, you know, from some who received it and some who did not receive it but wish they had received it. It was too late. And the feedback is that it really is something that brings you comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is a lasting memory.
I was just thinking.
Yeah.
It's, you know, something that, you know, that baby and their parents will have forever of their time.
That's it, yeah. And we did have the conversation, you know, my daughter and I, when we were putting it together, and she had said to me, "Mum, we can't really give that to, you know, what if it ends in a sad end and what if the baby doesn't make it?" And sadly, these things happen. So I thought about it, and then my answer was, any baby that is brought into this world has had a life, has had a story, a journey, and it really matters.
Yeah.
And that book would be something to somebody who had gone through that. And I have worked with a relative who had gone through the experience.
Right.
And it was her who had, she had signed that off and said, yes,
I
would have loved that.
Yeah.
So it went from there then. Parents are loving it. They really are.
That's good. And in terms of the mental health, have you seen, you know, from your time working as a neonatal nurse to now, have you seen an increase in that need for mental health support? Have you seen an increase in mental health issues with parents?
Yeah, so I did my training during COVID. Mm-hmm. So COVID just hit when I just started university. So that was a whole new thing for everybody in the world. But trying to do nursing as a student nurse was crazy. I was lucky enough in my last year at uni to do a placement in health visiting because I was always passionate about babies and children. So that was the decider for me. That was why I went on ahead with it. But I was able to go out with my mentor into the community.
Mm-hmm.
I know we had gowns and visors and everything on us. But the number of women who had babies during COVID who were completely isolated, mental health was through the roof. It was shocking.
Mm.
I was only literally in a house and I would have to leave through respect that they would spend time with her, because they broke down. They were so lonely.
Yeah.
And they weren't coping. I know when I had my children, my mother was there. She was at the breakfast, dinner and tea, mopping floors, everything. But that was one thing you noticed whenever you were out during COVID, that there was nobody. The grannies couldn't come.
Yeah.
The daddies were away working. She was there. She was pretending. She was okay, but she wasn't. You know, and that was shocking. That was my first encounter then with the perinatal mental health side of things. And I attended a conference with them through that placement. And then it was then that it started, really, the project started from that. But I've seen a lot of people who, and that I would be talking to at these events, they'll come and talk to me. It could be people in their 60s, 70s.
But they've kind of held kind that of all year?
They've held that all their lives. And then people who have actually nursed, their babies that have actually nursed, those parents are also reaching out. You know, they're also coming on board on this journey, and they think it's fantastic, and they're able to connect as well with all their parents that went through it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm hoping now in the autumn, I'm due to launch my first podcast series.
Very good.
So I have lined up program for that with, you know, health professionals and parents, the siblings, even children coming on to talk how it affected them and the grandparents. I'm trying to hit all those aspects again, and inclusivity as well with that there. And not just here in Ireland, but it's a global thing. So,
and that's great, because there's still such a stigma around mental health, but someone can put on a podcast, put their headphones in, nobody knows what they're listening to. And it's that, you know, link then to yourself. They can reach out, you know, and, you know, the awareness of these packs, that they can pass on that as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, some would contact me and we would have to chat, and we're both crying.
Yeah.
And that's all right. Because it's a very human experience, and it's really emotional.
Yeah.
So emotional. Imagine. And if you haven't seen it, or you haven't been that parent, you don't really
get it. Can't imagine at all.
And I find it really emotional when I'm dealing with it. But I know that I'm only looking on. I'm the shoulder. But for those parents who have gone through this, my heart goes out to them. You know,
but they're very lucky, you know, to have you as well. That, you know, you are there and you're willing to help. And that's, I think that's the most important thing, even about having these conversations on the radio. People know your name now, that you can help them, you can be that, you know, comfort and voice, or you can signpost them, as you said, to someone else that can really help them.
Yeah.
So remind us, Belle, of your website again.
So my website is called nicuandyou.co.uk. So that's NICU and ANDYOU.co.uk.
And then the fundraising event now on Friday the 25th of July.
Yeah, so that is being held in Oakfield Park in Rafoe. They have very kindly given us the venue for the day. They've sponsored that, not charging us for that. We have the use of the green room. It's just off Buffer's Restaurant. It's lovely. It's absolutely lovely. And they're going to set it up. It's Shauna. She's going to set it up lovely. And we also have singer-songwriter Brian Hassan from hometown Strabane, who very kindly offered as well to do the music. So Brian's going to do a lot of singing that day. I hope he's ready and getting the voice prepared. He's doing all the singing. And we also have a few characters who are going to make a few wee appearances for the children. We have a colouring competition and face painting, and put out requests for home bakes, because there's nothing like a nice cake.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that the weather is on our side. But if it's not, get the wellies on and get the coat on,
everybody
on board, because we've got lots of cover. It's a beautiful place, and I'm so grateful too for that.
Absolutely. Belle, thank you so much for coming in today. And it's great to raise awareness of this and the pack that you have created. So I wish you well, and hopefully you can get some support from different organisations that will help you produce more of these. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Michaela.
Delighted now to be joined by Dr. Joe Kelly. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Good morning.
So you heard us talking about the Donegal flags.
Yes, I did.
I hear you have a view on that.
Well, I just think it's very interesting. We, you know, we're a very proud county, and the GAA is very much part of our families and very much part of our communities. And so I think the flags are very important. Mm. I mean, our national flag, I've always said that on historical sites, we should have our national flag, and on public buildings, we should fly our tricolour. We should cherish what the symbol of a flag means. And the Donegal flag is a very powerful symbol of who we are.
Mm.
And so here we are at an unbelievable moment in our own life history, that Jim McGuinness and his men have brought us to an unbelievable place in the sense of sporting excellence.
Mm.
And it's terribly important maybe to think that these are just ordinary men that have gone out, so to speak, to do battle on a field of war, so to speak, and they have reached the pinnacle.
Yeah.
And these are Donegal men doing for Donegal with a Donegal manager. So we should be extremely proud of what has been done. And to celebrate that, I have my flag
yeah.
up. I think it's very important that we celebrate this moment.
And
it's an unbelievable achievement. And I think you were very correct. Going ahead, yeah.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, I was speaking earlier and it seemed years ago flags would have been out long before, you know, teams got through the semi-final into the All-Ireland final. There does seem to be a bit of a shift in terms of that.
Well, I think one of your contributors or comments that were made was quite correct. I personally don't like the mid-summer All-Ireland final. It was beautiful when it was in September. Schools were back. It was the beginning of the winter period. And this
yeah.
was a brilliant celebration of colour, of excitement among children. The GAA is rooted in communities. It's the young people that play the football. It's the young people that are looking up to the players that are playing on that field on Sunday week. So in that sense, we're losing that aspect of it. And I think the GAA really needs to look at that there. With regards to, I listened to the regards to the fee, I think that €100 for the best national game is, it seems to be quite high. But when you compare that to what's costing to go to an English soccer game, in relative terms, the GAA is an earthed, community-grown, voluntary organisation, the length and breadth of the country, that has achieved so much. If you go into every community and look at the quality of football fields we have, the quality of dressing rooms we have, this is all done voluntarily.
Mm.
And so our GAA, when I go into the Croke Park, I'm so proud. This is ours. This belongs to us. This has happened because of every person in the length and breadth in the communities of Ireland working to make this happen. And again, I love the word amateur. It's an amateur sport. And the word in Latin, amore, means to love. You do it because of the love
yeah.
of what you do, not because of the professionalism, because you get paid. And that's the difference between the soccer, for example, and the Gaelic. Like when we go out, and whether you're Tyrone or Donegal or Derry or Dublin, when you put on your jersey, this is us. This
yeah.
is what we are.
And it is your identity. You know, as you mentioned, it is your national game. As I was saying yeah. earlier, I'm more of a fair weather fan. I wouldn't claim that I watch it all year round. But yeah. even I was saying I'm from Tyrone. But there's such a lovely buzz here in Donegal. And, you know, it is our national game. And we should celebrate it when it comes round, be it, you know, in a couple next week or September.
Yeah, absolutely. And like even yesterday, the girls, was it yesterday that they won the under-16C All-Ireland, the Donegal girls?
Mm-hmm.
A number of the girls that I teach myself as in secondary school and two from my own club, you know, Eddie and Aoife from Clohanealy were on the team. And it's just wonderful to
yeah.
see success at a very local level. This is rooted in communities, and here Jim hopefully, and I am very confident, will win this game for us. But it's a brilliant journey that he's taken us
yeah.
on. And maybe something that I touch on as well is I would have taught some of the former county players, the likes of Colm Matney, Christy Toy, Rory Kavanagh. I would have taught them when I was in St Eunan's
mm-hmm.
and others as well. But I remember when Colm Matney retired, and I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but I actually wrote to him. And I wrote him a letter thanking him for all the times that he brought joy into my life in those games
mm-hmm.
that he played over the years. Jim McGuinness and his team have brought joy and hope and lifted the whole county.
Absolutely.
So these men are training hard, sacrificing, disciplining themselves so much. But they might get an All-Ireland medal out of this, but what they do for our communities
mm-hmm.
and what they do for our own mental health and the summers, the joy that it brings into our summers. And so I wrote to him to thank him for that. And I don't think he had realised that that was how powerful what he was
yeah.
doing. It's the same for Michael Murphy or anybody else. What these men do for us is phenomenal.
Mm.
And we should really, really acknowledge and get behind them and appreciate what the sacrifices that they've made as amateurs, people that really love the sport and, more importantly, love our county.
Yeah.
And that's everything.
And it is a huge sacrifice. You mentioned, you know, you were comparing the price of the tickets for the match compared to, say, an English football match. Do you think then that there is that argument again that, you know, they could be paid some kind of fee because the dedication, you know, the food that they have to eat, you know, their diet's set out, there's so much expense for, you know, they do get subsidised in some way, but there's such an expense for them as well.
Yeah, well, I think that's where the GPA, that, you know, the Players Association has a pivotal role in ensuring that happens. And there has been progress there. I think there's more could be done in that regard. And just knowing the calibre of Jim McGuinness, and I remember reading an article back when he took over the managerial position almost 2 years ago, the man that was writing, I think it was Cahill, he wrote about, this is a wonderful journey these young men are going to go on. It's not just a journey in football. It's a journey into manhood, to responsibility. It's going to be a Donegal journey. The players' welfare is terribly, terribly important. And yes, they should be looked after. With health, with you know, with their food and expenses, absolutely. And I think, again, nobody would begrudge them for the sacrifice they have made. And it's very important to say, not just Donegal, that's across all levels of the sport, including the female, the LGA, the Ladies Gaelic Association. I mean, those girls make equally as much sacrifices in winning their All-Ireland. And that should be understood and appreciated. It's very important. And so look, if the money, and I don't think the GAA is a grab-all association, when you go and look at what assets the GAA owns, and it's all generated from our communities. And Croke Park belongs to every GAA club in this country. And for example, hurling maybe isn't as popular up here. There is money being allocated into counties like ours to promote hurling. That costs, that, and people have to be paid for that. So in a way, the GAA reallocate that money, and it's very, the GAA is very, very transparent with its financial expenditure. And there's nobody as such benefiting, getting a bonus for getting more income or anything out there. Any money that's made is spent within the GAA family and within the GAA community. And that has to be acknowledged. It's a wonderful, is there a, or an organisation in the world like it? I don't think so.
And I suppose that's, it's part of Ireland's history. You know, you mentioned, you know, Croke Park belongs to everybody. And that's just, you know, you think about years gone by, where this game started to where it is now, the professionalism of, you know, the training and everything. It has evolved to such an amazing standard.
Absolutely. And again, that's very much, much harder on the players. And I'm sure Anthony Molloy and Mark McHugh would be able to talk more about that. The kind of standards expected of them when they won the All-Ireland in 92, and compare that to 2012, and now compare that to when we won the All-Ireland in 2025, please God. There's a massive trajectory of more professionalism. There's more demand, there's more training, and it's harder on the body. There's more commitment. And like, again, it impacts on their lives, on their relationships, on their families. It's a massive, massive sacrifice these people are making. And that should be acknowledged. And it's just wonderful that it's very earthed. And but here, the point that maybe needs to be considered, Michaela, is the true heroes of the GAA. And I think any county player wearing a Donegal jersey on Sunday week in Croke Park with a Donegal one will admit that they're there because of all the countless men and women that have trained them over the years, from under sixes to under eights to under 12s. They're in every club. And I have four boys, and they're all playing underage GAA football. And the time that managers give to my children and to every other child, the length and breadth of this country through the GAA infrastructure, has to be commended. It is unbelievable. And we don't get county players. They just don't arrive. They're trained from a very early age. And what is lovely to see is, as players are no longer maybe playing themselves, they come back into their clubs and then they start training these
pass on them skills. Well, Joe, you were...
And that's just wonderful to see. That I think, look into Croke Park and saying, this is us, this is our team.
And seeing the... the Donegal jersey running about. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Joe, you came on to talk about something else, but I'm going to take a quick break and we'll be back with that in a couple of minutes. Now we're in the company of Dr. Joe Kelly and we're going to change the conversation from flags. And Dr. Kelly, you have been questioning what's going on and why is the Irish government constantly failing in their duty to Irish people?
Well, Joe will do. but yes, my concern is, and people are aware of it now, with Stanich and Simon Harris saying, you know, we have to, the government are alarmed with what's happening with Trump in America. And look, the issue isn't Trump. Trump's job is to look after America. Our government's job is to look after Ireland. Mm-hmm. And what concerns me is that we have delegated our economic future to EU unelected officials. We are outside the table of negotiations when it comes to our economic future with America. We're not directly talking to Trump or Trump's administration. Mm-hmm. It's the EU that are talking to Trump on our behalf. And the lead man is Seth Kovic, and he's talking on behalf of us. And I find that very, very concerning. Mm. We seem to have, as a country, outsourced nearly everything of our sovereignty. And I've talked to Greg before about that. So our economic sovereignty now is being handed over to Ursula von der Leyen, who's unelected, mm-hmm. president of the EU, and her officials. Our immigration policy has been handed over to the EU. We've got sovereign independence we can share, absolutely, but give all away and
Joe, your connection's just playing up there. I might get you to reconnect and then we can pick up that conversation again. It's just freezing on me there now at the minute. We'll take a few of your comments in the meantime while we get Dr. Joe Kelly to hopefully reconnect with us there. So the team are such great athletes and dare I say it, they're a very handsome bunch of men too, this listener believes. And the ladies team did great this year. It's not fair, the price of all the Donegal tickets were being skinned for it, another listener believes. I want to show all my support and many cannot. We all love Donegal but it's just sad how expensive it is. Most people agree that the change in date for the final in September was a lovely time for it. Yeah, that has been quite a common opinion. And I remember, you know, being at school and you're always looking forward to the Monday off. I don't know, do they still do that if your team's in the All-Ireland final? Do they give you the Monday off afterwards? But I remember you always used to look forward to it. Another listener says, I got a wee teddy for Donegal that was €7.90. As it relates to our conversation with Belle Stevenson, 100% agree with this wonderful lady. As a mommy of two emergency sections babies, I experienced this and I was so lost when I didn't have my babies with me at the start. While I was in recovery, Daddy was with both babies until I and my boys were getting the treatment we needed. Thank you, wonderful lady, for doing this. So yeah, it's a great initiative that Belle has started up, these packs that contain a book, and you know, they're there for the parents to kind of explain and help them and be that little support for them whenever their baby is in the neonatal unit. I was left 2 hours after having a C-section. When I got to the ward to see my baby, all my family was there. I felt left out, no connection with my baby, wanted to breastfeed my child 10 down, and I'm still feel he's 10, they're 10 now, and I still feel that separation from him. They do say that, you know, that skin-to-skin interaction is vital as well. And, you know, I suppose like any mother or any father, whatever, you know, having that interaction initially is so important. So delighted to hear about this, another listener says, with regards to the neonatal pack that Belle had had come up with. She was explaining that it was in relation, it followed a what she had done at university, and she felt the need, you know, was there. There was such a gap in services and support. I hope to be able to join Dr. Joe Kelly again. Good morning again, Joe.
Michaela, I'm sorry about the line this morning. Apologies.
You're grand. Don't worry. We got the Donegal flags, main point anyway. So back to Ursula von der Leyen.
Yes. Yeah, well, she's basically negotiating on behalf of the Irish people and our economy. And I have really concerns about how we're outsourcing our sovereignty when it comes to economics, when it comes to immigration, when it comes to even, you've been talking about CAPS, Common Agricultural Policy, mm-hmm. how now that budget is no longer going to be ring-fenced, which is going to have a detrimental effect on our farming communities here in Ireland. And we're expecting unelected EU officials to negotiate on our behalf. We're not in the talks about the future of our economy with relation to America. There's something not right about that. And so when Simon Harris or Tanja says we need to be honest with the people and what our interlockers, what the people representing us are saying, these are not Irish people with Irish interests at heart. And just to put it in context, Volkswagen, for example, in Germany, it's worth 8% of their economy, their GDP. And they're going to make sure that whatever tariffs are going to be coming their way, mm-hmm. they're going to try to protect their automobile industry. We have a pharmaceutical industry, which is 45% of all exports from this country, which is worth about 99 to 100 billion a year. Massive. To us. We're the third biggest country in the world exporting pharmaceuticals. And it's going to have a detrimental impact on us should there be any tariffs, and it's going to really, really hit us very hard. At the moment, Ireland exports about 72 billion to America, and we import about 25 billion. So Trump's administration has been saying, look, there's a 50,000 million deficit in Ireland alone, and this can't go on. But what maybe people don't realise is that money that we get from American companies that are based here is about 24 billion revenue a year. Mm. And that's what's kept our country afloat in the last number of years. That's what's paying for our immigration intake. That's what's paying for a lot of our bills, our special needs, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And if that money doesn't come in, we're in a very precarious position.
And the government's approach seems to be wait and see if it comes in. There's no urgency to put any measures in place or to, you know, think towards the budget now. Where are we going to facilitate this 30% tariff?
Well, it's not even that. And I know that they're trying to do that. They have an economic unit now in America, which they should have had years ago, looking at what the Trump or the American administration are going to do. But it's like playing the All-Ireland final. We talked about it there on Sunday. Jim McGuinness can't win that game unless the team actually physically appear on the field. Mm-hmm. How can our economic future be safe if the very people we elect are not on the field to represent us? Mm. So we're depending on unelected EU officials to bat for us, and they're going to put their concerns before ours. I have no doubt about that. And history, and this is the beautiful thing about knowing history, history teaches us that. So let's go back to 2008 when we had the economic downturn. And we owned Germany 17,000 million. And the Germans made us pay them back because their banks needed to be recuperated, that money, pensioners' money, etc. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have the money. And the Germans said, well, we'll give you the loan of money that you can borrow billions from us. We'll borrow it for you and then we'll give it to you. And the Irish government said, well, that's okay. How much will you give it to us? You know, how much? Mm. Well, we'll give you whatever amount you need at 7 or 8%. Now, Germany were able to borrow that money at 2 and 3%. They charged an extra 5% on us because we were in a hard place. This is our EU friends.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, across the water, England, Cameron, and making this very simple, phones up Cowan and says, you're in a bit of a predicament. I am, yeah. Do you want some money? Yeah, we'd love some money. How much do you need? Well, how much can you get us? He says, right, I'll get you 7 billion. England borrowed 7 billion through their own country and gave us a loan. And Cowan said to them, well, what interest rate do you want? I'll charge you only the interest rate that the banks, the world banks, are charging me, which was 2 or 3%. Our true friends were the English. Mm-hmm. Our European counterparts screwed us financially with the interest rates. They made money on us when we were in a hard place. Now, we are expecting those same EU countries to negotiate on our behalf and protect our medical and pharmaceutical products. I don't think that's going to happen.
And is it the same attitude towards other countries in Europe, or do you think Ireland has just, you know, given off this impression that they're happy enough to go along with whatever's happening in Europe?
Well, I think that we've been having this discussion for quite some time. Like, Europe has destroyed our fisheries. There's no question about that. It's now in the process of dismantling Irish farming. And the government knows that it's only a few farmers this time. It's only a few fishermen. It's only, and bit by bit, they break us down. And it seems to be that everything is about Europe and nothing about Ireland. Even our MEPs, you know, I question, we elect MEPs to represent us in Europe, but it appears that our MEPs represent Europe and Ireland. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a massive democratic deficit there. It's just concerning. And I just wonder, are we given too much of our powers and our authority and our sovereignty away to the EU? And this has gone across not just economics, migration and everything else. And we just seem to have become apathetic and complacent about this. And it's very, very concerning and alarming. And even more so, if you look at one of our presidential candidates now that's in the race, Mairead McGuinness, former EU commissioner. I mean, honestly, can we trust her with the Irish constitution? Considering that she sat beside Ursula von der Leyen, that supported Israel. And our president had to stand up and say, no, you're not speaking on behalf of the people of Ireland. And Mairead McGuinness was a commissioner sitting at that table. Mm. So the question is now, we're talking about giving her the role of president and taking control, so to speak, or protecting our constitution. I think our constitution and our neutrality and our economics and our fishing and our farming has all been just handed away. And it's very, very alarming and very concerning. So when we talk about the Trump and the tariffs, people would want to have us focus on Trump. I think the focus has to be on ourselves. What is our government doing for us? Not what are Europe doing for us. What are our elected TDs that we elect directly doing for us and with regards to our sovereignty? And I just find it very, very concerning. And maybe that's just an issue to think about. How we are progressing as a country. Have we abdicated all responsibility for governance in our own country and handed it away to unelected EU officials?
Because we do see, you know, the likes of the Taoiseach and Taoiseach travelling to Europe and they're attending these hugely important meetings. But do you think then that it's just a face-showing exercise at this stage?
Well, the question maybe is, and it's a very good point, is it a face-showing exercise? Why do we have to be the good boys and good girls of Europe all the time? Mm. Like, when have we ever stood up to Europe and said, no, our best interests are not being served in this regard? And it's not saying that you're anti-European. I'm all for a collaboration with all the EU 27 countries, absolutely, and also with the UK that have left the EU. Economically, if we can work together, absolutely. But giving away our sovereignty is an issue that we need to really consider more deeply. And I think the presidential campaign, hopefully that will come into focus more. Like, 80% of our laws, as Sian Kelly, the MEP in Cork, has pointed out, has come from Europe. I don't know if you're aware that when you're listening in Highland, maybe think of this thought. Since 2000, that's 25 years, in the last 25 years, the Irish government has passed 18,400 laws. Mm. They're regulating the hell out of us. And most of these laws are European laws. 18,400 laws. That works out about 9 laws a day per dial setting that has been passed on the Irish people. And it's we're being regulated and regulated and regulated and regulated. Do you know what I would love to see? Maybe getting our Gardaí number up to 18,400 and giving them some power to enforce the laws that are already there rather than introducing more laws and more laws. And a lot of these laws are coming from Europe and aren't being, as far as I'm concerned, communicated directly to the people of Ireland. And in realistic terms, I don't think anybody can actually contemplate understanding 18,400 laws and what that all means. And some of these laws haven't been good.
Yeah. And do you what do you think, Joe, needs to change? Obviously, the Irish government needs to speak up a bit more. But do you think, you know, you referenced there Ursula von der Leyen, you know, she's unelected. Do you think people right across Europe should have an input into, you know, an election in terms of that role?
Look, I think a lot of people feel they've given up. They've lost hope. They feel that they can't change anything. What difference does my voice make?
Yeah.
And a lot of people have just lost that hope. And there's kind of a political darkness and sort of, what can I do?
Mm.
And I think we're in a situation like that. And people have let them take control or government. You see, government, a proper democracy is when the government's afraid of the people. Tyranny is when the people are afraid of the government. And our government doesn't seem to care and doesn't seem to listen to the people. And the last referendum we had back just last year, when they wanted to remove the word mother and woman and mm-hmm. family from the constitution, was overwhelmingly, it was the biggest no vote in the history of the country in a referendum. And yet the government bypassed our no by bringing in hate speech legislation.
Mm.
So in other words, they ignored the voice of the people in that referendum. And Helen McEntee, through her role as Minister of Justice, brought in hate speech laws that circumnavigated some of the things that they wanted to get in the first place. They know that people are too busy with life, paying mortgages, too busy trying to get ahead of in life, that they don't have time to challenge the system and challenge what's happening. And that's true. And we get tired. We all get tired. We have mortgages to pay. We have kids to rear. We have parents, you know, might have to look after, or people with special needs or whatever it is in our lives. We all live very busy lives. But in the process, somewhere along that busyness, the government know that they can take us for granted and move the goalposts in directions that we don't necessarily would want. And so therefore, I think the whole thing maybe boils down to our presidential election. It's going to be terribly,
well, Joe,
terribly
important. A listener has asked, would Dr. Joe consider putting himself forward for president? They say you talk a lot of sense. There you go, Joe. A career move.
Well, would you vote for you, Michaela? look, I understand you can't answer that question. Listen, I wouldn't say no to anything.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, I'm not saying yes and I'm not saying no. In that sense, I haven't, you know. But look, yeah, why not have a young family in the Aris? Why not have somebody that's not part
something
of the
different.
Political elite? Yeah, well, look at all the people coming forward at the moment. They're all part of the political elite. Like Catherine Connolly, for example, she's on whatever, 120,000 a year. Mairead McGuinness, I would swap a month of my wages for a year of, or I would give her, sorry, for a month of her pension, I would offer a year of my wages.
Mm. Yeah, it's so unrelatable to everyday people.
Well, it's not just that. They're part of the system. They're part of the legislators. These are the people that have given us 18,400 laws. And you see, the thing that I would love to see, you see, the people of Ireland, the beating heart of Ireland isn't in the marble floors of the EU or the carpeted floors of the Dáil. It's out among the people of Ireland. And I question, and maybe this is maybe what your listeners can think of, is the conversations on Highland Radio and elsewhere that's been heard and talked about at the kitchen table reflected in our cabinet table? Or is it that the government cabinet table is forcing their agenda onto our kitchen table where we talk?
Mm.
And I think that's where the problem is. We have an agenda-driven government forcing their agenda onto our kitchen tables. And we don't get our agenda onto the government table. And the only person that can fix that, I believe, at this stage is our president.
Yeah.
And I think the president has various competencies, five competencies as such within the constitution. There's quite a lot. And it just seems to belong to the political elite at the moment.
Mm.
Look, for example, trying to get a nomination. It's almost impossible.
And even trying to garner that support and go around different councils and lobby different Oireachtas members.
Yes.
Joe, unfortunately, time's beaten us. It was lovely to talk to you today. It's always food for thought whenever you're on. So thank you so much for joining me this morning.
My good luck to you. Slán.